Welcome to the Strong Starts podcast with your hosts, Jessica Whitehead.
Hey, folks,
and
welcome back
Gilbert
to the Strong Starts podcast. Thank you all for listening and subscribing and for following us on social media. We are at Strong Starts Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And Jessica, it's a bit ironic that we're talking about resilience on this episode since we scrapped the original episode less than 24 hours ago and then had to push through and figure out what in the world we were going to record today. But we were resilient and we made it.
Yes, proof that resilience really works. And we've got an episode for you to show for it.
Yes, absolutely. So here's what happened. Last episode, we were talking about restraint and seclusion, and it was probably my favorite episode we've done so far. And in that episode, we advocated for the abolition of exclusionary practices, particularly for students with disabilities, restraint and seclusion being some of those exclusionary practices, also suspensions and expulsions. But if we're advocating against exclusion, we figured, okay, we should probably talk about inclusion at some point. And that was going to be our episode today. We were going to talk about inclusion, what it is and isn't, inclusive practices, and maybe we'll still do that on a future episode. But while we were preparing for all that, we hit a wall because there's something that really hits different when you're talking about inclusive practices while you're trying to implement them with students. So a little bit of background. When we started this podcast, it was the summer. We weren't working with kids, but now we're back in a new school year. We're working with students, and everything that we talk about now on the show, it really feels different. In fact, Jessica, maybe we could have done the episode on inclusion if we had done it over the summer, but then it wouldn't have been authentic. It wouldn't have been true to what we're trying to do on the show.
Yeah, so we were talking about inclusion, and what happened was it started to feel really big and really heavy. And we started to feel confused and unsure of ourselves because there's a difference between talking about the best practices that we research for the show and the reality we're living in. Because the reality is all students are in our rooms and the challenges are growing. The behaviors are so varied and the problem behaviors seem so complicated. We also know that there are laws changing, staffing shifts, and changes in the system that seem outside of our control. At the same time, we're dealing with our own nervous systems firing and everything getting activated, including memories from when I was a kid, all the way to memories from last year when I worked with a student and felt like I failed. And as we were grappling with this episode and trying to work it out, we had to shift gears towards something positive. So we started to think about what the people we've worked with before throughout our careers who lived these challenges and didn't turn away did. They remained resilient. So that's what we want to talk about today.
I totally agree with you, 100%. It became so much harder when we were living these realities day to day. And so, you know, we had this idea of how the school year was going to start out. And based on the work that we'd been doing, we felt pretty confident in it. We felt good about the systems that we had in place. But then we had a few surprises, as we do every year. And, you know, what I do know is we're not alone in this line of thinking.
We are definitely not. The moment you walk through the doors of a school, you feel it. The educators are in survival mode. They are trying to manage student behaviors while also meeting the diverse academic needs of every student. A recent survey from NEA Today of almost 3,000 educators confirms what we already know. 80% of educators claim that student behavior has become a significant and increasing concern. Problem behavior is one of the leading causes of stress among educators. We can place blame on things like the mental health crisis, the pandemic, academic demands, the push for inclusion, staff shortages, funding cuts, lack of support, broken systems, discipline practices, and the focus on test scores and achievement. And the list could probably even be longer. The reality is, education as a whole is more heavily staffed than ever before and has more funding than ever before. Yet data has not shown an improvement. Restraints and isolations have remained steady across the nation, and academic scores have actually decreased since 2019.
And hearing that there hasn't been a change in data, it really makes this very heavy because demands are already so high and plates are already so full, and our students are changing at a faster rate than our system can really change. Among these demands, we have the push for inclusionary practices. That's something that we hear about all the time. We want all of our students to have their needs met in our general education classrooms. We want the school environment to be set up to foster that sense of belonging for everybody because that's something that's important to us as educators. And when it comes down to our classroom teachers, there isn't just one perspective or one universal experience, even though we're all feeling the same demand. So let's talk about three examples of teachers who vary in their beliefs about inclusionary practices and take a look at their approach. Just a disclaimer, these teachers in these scenarios are completely fictional, but they might resemble what we're seeing in schools today, and you may be able to relate with them.
Yeah, teacher one, that's Sarah. Sarah just received a new student in her classroom with a significant learning disability. She talks to the case manager about what accommodations she needs to put in place. She also asks the administrator about what they can do to support collaborative time so that the student's needs can be met in the classroom. The teacher also researches Universal Design for Learning, or UDL, and asks if she can attend a webinar so that the student can stay in the general education classroom.
Okay, so that's one approach. Now let's take a look at teacher number two, James. James understands the push for inclusion. He has even seen how some of his students have benefited socially from being around their peers. However, his class size is already high, and he struggles with the extra time that it takes to prepare for the varying needs of his students. He also worries that students with high needs will impact the learning of his other students. He tries his best, but he feels like the current system doesn't support him and his students involved enough.
And the third approach from teacher three, Jessica sees inclusion as another thing that she has to do. She is already overwhelmed with the new curriculum, high class numbers, and the number of students in her classroom with an IEP. She thinks that students with IEPs would be better served in a separate setting where they can get more individualized and focused support. That way, she can focus on her core curriculum and helping the rest of her students make academic progress. So with all of those scenarios, it's easy to connect some way, some shape or form with each of these teachers. They come to work wanting students to succeed. They have the same goal, academic achievement, student progress, student growth. They all get paid the same, work at the same school under the same leadership. But what's the real difference between them? What truly motivates an educator to go above and beyond to research and advocate, even when they are not required to? Because let's face it, there's no trophy given out during the day for who does the most inclusionary practices. We are going to explore this question a little deeper and talk about resilience to change and how we can move forward.
Yes, let's dive into resilience. So resilience is the ability to persevere through challenges and bounce back after your setbacks. And we all grew up learning about resilience, you know, in different ways. I grew up hearing pick yourself up by your bootstraps, or hey, you made your bed, now lie in it, things like that.
Yeah. And I grew up hearing things like put on your big girl pants, or well, life isn't fair, and many of the other classic 80s and 90s parenting phrases.
But the thing is, resilience is deeper than that. It's not just getting over a problem or numbing yourself to it. There's something more to it.
Even when we teach resilience to students, we teach them to have a growth mindset, to see failures not as the end of the world, but as an opportunity to learn, and that mistakes are an opportunity to learn and grow. In our example, Sarah, James, and Jessica all faced challenges in their classrooms, but the way they thought about those challenges was different. Their level of resilience was different.
Yeah, and there's been some really interesting research done about levels of resilience in the last 5 years, actually as a reaction to the pandemic, which was, you know, this community adversity that we all face. So researchers wanted to understand how we develop resiliency in the face of such adversity. And one study found that 35% of the general population reports having low levels of resilience. Whether or not this is always true in our communities, this is certainly something that we felt among the folks that we work with and come in contact with. And there's been this kind of shift towards feeling like we can't handle those challenges that we're given.
Resilience describes something neurological that happens within us after we've experienced a trauma. Trauma can alter the brain's wiring, and resilience describes our level of ability to mediate the effects of trauma in the brain. There are a variety of factors that contribute to our resilience, but one of the most important is our locus of control. Do we feel like our lives are controlled by what happens within us or by what happens outside of us? People with high internal locus of control are generally more resilient. They believe that they are in control of their fate.
Yeah, and our locus of control is impacted by many, many factors. So we just wanted to kind of make note of that. So early childhood experiences, genetics, epigenetics, there's many factors that contribute to whether we feel like we're in charge of our own fate or the world outside of us is in charge of our fate. And these early experiences, what they do is they shape our prefrontal cortex in our brain. That's the part of the brain that's responsible for our locus of control. But that locus of control, that sense that like I'm responsible for my own fate, it can also be cultivated. And there's a lot of various therapeutic techniques to gain a stronger sense of control over ourselves and our fate. That includes the way that we process the events that happen in our lives, how we self-regulate, how we talk to ourselves about what's happening, kind of those stories that we tell ourselves about what's happening in our lives. All of these things can grow that sense of control over ourselves.
Yeah, and like we mentioned, there are a variety of protective factors that increase someone's resilience and can help cultivate it. Many of those factors happen early on in life, and we can't control that piece for ourselves. Some we can control, or at least cultivate, so that we can improve our resilience later in life. Those include our self-regulation, sense of purpose and optimism, and strong, concrete community support. And I know that I'm still working on all of those things myself. And resilience can be tricky. As humans, we naturally avoid the hard. And it's not like resilience suddenly makes you a better counselor or teacher or principal.
No, not at all. But what resilience does do is it shifts the way that we see our challenges, because we know we're going to face those challenges anyway. That's our reality that we're living in. And those challenges are rapidly increasing way faster than our systems are changing in response. And so a very normal human reaction would be to feel completely out of control and just shut down.
Oh, yeah. I even deal with this as a parent. And my own children. And when they are struggling or something is hard and they're facing this big challenge, and just helping them work through that, that resilience piece is something we've been working on since they were little. And sometimes, you know, we have to talk to them. You can choose the hard. You can choose resilience. And when we do that, we can cultivate a belief that this is within our control and that we can and must be able to handle these challenges. We could change our narrative away from seeking to blame and shame others for what we think is happening to us and shift towards ownership of the task at hand. These are my students. I am their educator. Their behavior is communication, and I will work to meet their needs.
Yes, I love that. And resilience makes it so much easier for us to hold ourselves accountable for what is happening within our educational system. A few episodes back, we discussed models of accountability, and one was this idea that we're all accountable to each other. We're accountable to the students and families that we serve, but also to our colleagues, to our administrators, and to the system as a whole. We're responsible to anyone that we have a relationship with. And this is so much easier to do when we actually believe, really believe, that we can handle the challenges that face us.
Yeah. And so when we think about that, let's return to the example of the three teachers we gave earlier. All of them work within the same formal accountability systems. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about evaluations, the credentialing requirements, administrators that oversee them. But these teachers feel a sense of accountability differently. There isn't a trophy handed out, like we talked about earlier, for teachers who implement these practices and do these extra work hours outside of their contract time or attend the most webinars. But when we look at Sarah, she felt personally responsible for the educational outcomes of her student and for the functionality of the entire system. And she felt accountable to her students and her colleagues to find the way to get there. This felt accountability propelled her to seek solutions and change her practice to meet her students' needs. James felt personally responsible for the educational outcome of his students. This felt accountability propelled him to try to make changes to his practice, but ultimately left him feeling guilty and defeated. Jessica, on the other hand, she felt accountable to the traditional systems of accountability, data and test scores, achievement and growth. This propelled her to find a path where she could teach the curriculum and put the rest of the challenges of teaching onto someone else.
Yes. And before I worked in education, I worked other jobs in social services. And when one of my earliest jobs, I really failed at feeling accountable to the people that I worked with. Unlike the example of the other Sarah, the teacher, in our earlier examples, I struggled really quite a bit in that position. I lacked the training. I lacked an understanding of the true scope of the job. I didn't know how to work with the kids that I was working with. And so I struggled and I made a lot of mistakes. And I still struggle in my current position. I still make mistakes. But the difference between now and then is that now I really seek to understand and find answers when I'm struggling. And I reach out to other people. And 15 years ago, I just felt guilty and ashamed when I couldn't figure it out. I felt like a failure. I said nothing. And I just hoped that someone else would fill in those gaps when I was falling short. I didn't feel accountable to myself or the kids that I served. And really, I couldn't. It's not that I didn't want to. I couldn't, because the moment that I tried to feel responsible and to look for solutions, I just started to feel inadequate. And all that shame just made me shut down. So I put up this wall, this emotional wall, and I just tried to do the job. You know, I just tried to do exactly what was listed in the job description, and I just made my mistakes everybody else's problem. I had very low resilience. And one of the benefits to being resilient is that we are able to be vulnerable and to ask for help when we don't know what to do.
Yeah, and it's so hard. And I've been there too as a teacher and as the BCBA, mm-hmm. is we feel like we want to know how to do the things, right? This is our mm-hmm. classroom and this is how we do things. And it's so hard sometimes to bend a little bit or to reach out and admit, hey, I can't do this, or I'm struggling to do this. I need help with this. And then, you know, managing that within our day, within our contract time. And so it is definitely a barrier. But what we do know is students' needs often go beyond those academic areas. So we can look to all these other experts. We have educators, speech pathologists, occupational therapists, special education teachers, physical therapists, counselors, psychologists, BCBAs, and we have administrators that all bring different expertise to the table. So by reaching out, we can learn from one another and share the load. We don't have to do it all by ourselves, even though sometimes it does feel like it, but we have so many people around us that can offer support.
Oh, 100%. And I think that pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality that some of us were raised with really lends itself more to the, hey, I'm going to struggle in silence. What we're suggesting is that, you know, if we feel accountable to everybody in the whole system, then maybe we can create more collaboration. But the time for collaboration can be a challenge, and we know that. Planning times rarely align outside of grade level groups, and depending on your district, your professional learning community meetings may only happen once a week. And even then, we can't be everywhere at once. So sometimes we have to get creative or advocate within our system for opportunities to make collaboration possible.
Yeah. And I know it's hard. There are definitely a lot of barriers that, you know, everyone has. And it's difficult for us to be able to address all those barriers from everybody within this episode. But some things, you know, we have seen that work and might be possible. Have to do around advocating for that time. And maybe you can ask for a sub so that you have time to sit down with a speech teacher to learn about a student's assistive technology. Maybe it means asking a staff member to cover your class or group so you can spend time with the student while they're taking a break in the sensory room. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can set up a system with a special education teacher to share and go over lesson plans so that they can pre-teach material or even reteach material. And all that seems heavy, but if we can make those small adjustments and just beg, right? If we're going around begging, please. When we can find those little pockets, that will really make some big changes. And leadership has the opportunity to see the system at large and identify resources that are needed to get us to meet student needs, whether it's scheduling collaboration, a training or coaching session, or having a difficult conversation.
Yes. And I know, and I agree with you, Jessica, these things do feel heavy, but you know, what we're really suggesting is not adding more to your plate, but augmenting your practices, making some small changes that really help to serve the system, because we all know that you're all putting in maximum effort. But sometimes, you know, we find ourselves kind of banging our heads against the wall because we keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And so these small changes can really make a big impact in what we do. And instead of despairing and hitting up against that wall about what's outside of our control, you know, let's focus on what is within our control and strengthen those parts of our system. So until next time, thank you all for listening. I hope you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us, please, on Strong Starts Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.